Film Spotting is brought to you by Spout.com, a gathering place for people who love movies. Sign up for free at filmspotting.spout.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Matty Robinson. This week, it's a very Film Spotting Christmas edition of the show. Adam and I have been making our lists, checking them twice, and now you're going to find out which filmmakers have been the nicest this year as we reveal our top 10 movies of 2007. With a little help from Chicago Tribune film critic Michael Phillips.
Michael will join us in a bit for the top 5 portion of the countdown. We'll also play Massacre Theater and review 3 new movies out this weekend, including Tom Hanks and Julia Roberts in Charlie Wilson's War, and the latest Tim Burton-Johnny Depp collaboration, Sweeney Todd, The Demon Barber of Fleet Street. But Maddie, before we jump into our top 10 countdown, let's hear a voicemail from one of our special guests.
What's up, Adam? Maddie, this is Matt Singer from IFC News. I would love to be a total contrarian and explain how, I don't know, Transformers is the best movie of 2007, but I'm going to have to go along with the consensus and say, yes, it's No Country for Old Men. And at this point, the film is just so universally praised, it's almost no fun to talk about it anymore. But I think the reason it is so highly regarded is because it really is just that well made and well acted and well shot and on and on and on. And I just think it's interesting that even people I've spoken to who claim to hate the Coen brothers, which is a ridiculous stance anyway, but whatever, admit that No Country works in just about every conceivable way a movie can work. Thanks for all the great 2007 podcasts, and I can't wait for plenty more in 2008. Bye, guys.
That was our friend Matt Singer from IFC chiming in with his number one film of the year, No Country for Old Men. And we will hear from a few more guest voicemailers here later in the show with their picks for the best films of the year. Let's go ahead and get into our list, though, now, Maddie. And I'm curious, did you have an easy time with your selections? Was there anything that just killed you to leave out? And what is your number 10?
Well, I have to tell you, I went with what I thought were the best achievements in film this year. I had a hard time leaving off some of my favorite films of the year.
Really? I would have thought you would go the other way, too.
Well, no, and this is my rationale, so hear me out. There are films probably in my top 10 that I'm not going to revisit that often. And there are movies like Superbad and The Mist, once they get on cable and I come across them, I'm probably going to watch them again. Like The Departed, it's on cable right now, and I'm coming across it every single night, and I will watch it. It's eminently watchable, but it wasn't one of my best films of 2006. So that said, my top 10 definitely are what I feel are the best achievements in film. A tad pedantic, I know, but of course, it's Film Spotting.
Okay, I can't wait. You're number 10.
All right, my number 10 is The Namesake by Mira Nair. I just got a chance to catch up with this film, and if I had seen this film before we made our list of top actors, Irfan Khan as the father would most certainly have made my best supporting actor list, or even best actor, because it's his story as this Indian-born man who bravely moves with his wife to the United States that really, really resonates with me. The quiet sacrifices that he makes for his family and the way his son, Gogol, attempts to relate with him, it just really hit home. I think it's just a beautiful study on the modern family dynamic.
Yeah, it's a really good film. I agree, did not make my list, but I too loved Irfan Khan. He did make my list of top 5 supporting actors. With my list, I had 3 factors I tried to consider here. First of all, enjoyment. How much fun was the movie to watch? Rewatchability. You kind of touched on both of these things. How badly do I want to see the movie again? And then the third one, which really is key, is this idea of transcendence. Did the movie provide moments of pleasure, whether they be technical, emotional, or whatever, where you almost feel like you're having an out-of-body experience? You become almost giddy because you're so in awe of what you're seeing on screen.
Did
I had moments like that.
You found 10 films that actually lived up to that criteria?
Yeah, I did, and not many more. In fact, I only left out 2 movies that even had a chance at making my top 10, so this wasn't that hard. The hard part was ranking the films. I really struggled with that, but forming the 10 movies really wasn't that difficult. And my number 10 is a documentary, The King of Kong, A Fistful of Quarters. This is Seth Gordon's documentary about two men battling for Donkey Kong supremacy. Billy Mitchell, who has to emerge, I think, as the best movie villain of the year, maybe even ahead of Javier Bardem in No Country for Old Men and Steve Wiebe. It's a movie about Donkey Kong, of course, but also just a really interesting character study of these two rivals who couldn't be more antithetical. And it's also about the larger gaming community and, dare I say, even something about America. That's my take on it anyway. But for me, the awe moment, that transcendent moment, and I have a few of these with all of my picks here, other than pretty much every time Billy Mitchell opens his mouth, when Steve Wiebe, the lovable loser who has never been able to rise to a challenge in his life, walks into FunSpot, this sort of mecca of gaming, unannounced, sits down at Donkey Kong, and proceeds to set a new record. It's a great moment. King of Kong's my number 10.
Oh, it's a great choice. All right, well, my number 9 is Away From Her. Sarah Polley's, of course, directorial debut. And I had a very personal reaction to this film. My grandmother lived with my family basically for 20 years, and I never knew her without Alzheimer's. To me, she was that funny person that lived in our downstairs, you know, that stole money from the collection plate and would just start walking to California. And in a sad way, I never knew her as my grandmother. And it wasn't until my mother spoke so eloquently at her funeral that I realized that my mom was losing a mom. And that's what's so devastating about this disease and this movie. Gordon Pinsent, of course, plays this man that is losing his life partner, this vibrant woman played by the wonderful Julie Christie. And he has to make some really demanding decisions, whether or not to accommodate her happiness or his. I love the way that Sarah Polley lets her actors go in this film. And also, she borrows from Adam Egoyan a bit in that she employs an effective economy of sound. The pauses in this film are really a sonata in themselves, I think.
I think they learned that in Canada. It's just bred in them. But you're right, this is a really great film. And the two lead performances there, Julie Christie and Gordon Pinsett, I believe we both had them in our top 5 lead performances of the year.
Oh, the soft understatement is just beautiful.
Yeah, it really is. Well, my number 9 is a little bit of a surprise, maybe, and it's actually Death Proof, Quentin Tarantino's half of the Grindhouse double
bill. So you're not giving it to Robert Rodriguez?
No, I am not. And it didn't make it onto my top 5 of the year so far back in July because I wanted to consider Grindhouse as one film with a sometimes fun but ultimately unfulfilling first half, that being Rodriguez's Planet Terror. But the more I thought about this list, the more I couldn't forget those awe-inspiring moments from Death Proof. The entire chase sequence at the end with Zoe Bell's amazing stunt work, and specifically when Kurt Russell starts bawling like a little schoolgirl when the girls he is stalking start fighting back. I love that. And then earlier in the film, the head-on collision car wreck. I'm not usually one of those film goers who geeks out on over-the-top car wrecks and violence, but this was the exception. It was awesome.
Now, are you counting the Death Proof part of Grindhouse, or are you going with the extended version, which they released on DVD later this year?
I'm just saying Death Proof as its own movie right now. Haven't seen the extended unrated version. Death Proof, as it is my number 9.
All right, fine. All right. Well, my number 8 is Into the Wild. For me, this was really the most surprising film of the year, and I have to say it's because I was on guard. I was on guard against, you know, a political diatribe from its director, Sean Penn, something along the lines of, you know, how we need to turn our back on society, look to nature to solve our problems. And of course, I've just probably been watching too much Fox News because that's not what he does here at all. He creates a mosaic of a film that just lives and breathes in its own complexity. He doesn't take sides. He doesn't aggrandize anything. And one thing I'd really love to see is Eddie Vedder snag a best song at the Oscars for his song Guaranteed in this film.
Yeah, it's a really great film. And I love your list so far, Maddie, because all 3 choices are wonderful and all 3 are movies that aren't on my list, but I really did consider them maybe in the top 15. So I'm glad they're getting some love from you. My number 8 is The Bourne Ultimatum, which I think is a great action film and a perfect ending to the Bourne trilogy, if they do decide to end it there. And I love how Paul Greengrass, the director, doesn't let himself get complacent. And I remember hearing an interview with him on The Treatment where he talked about how even though this is a big-budget Hollywood movie, he likes to keep things like an independent film, make it a challenge so they don't fall into this complacency on the set. And so what he does, he gives himself these 3 set pieces and he makes them as difficult as you could possibly make them. You've got a foot chase in the market in Tangier, a car chase in New York City, and this cat and mouse hunt in Waterloo Station in London. I mean, if you were going to pick the most difficult places to do those things, a car chase in New York City, you know, obviously isn't a really smart idea, but I love all 3 of those moments. The filmmaking is incredible, but for me, the awe moment is the Waterloo Station sequence with Bourne, played by Matt Damon, of course, and a reporter, Patty Considine. They try to exchange information without getting caught or killed by the CIA, who has about 100 agents in pursuit of them. So well choreographed and intense, and it's shot so that you feel like you're there in the crowd. It's got that kind of pseudo-documentary handheld style, but it also pulls back just enough to keep you from being disoriented. We know where the characters are in relation to the space and the other people after them at all times. It's just brilliant.
All right, well, I'm going to go from one side of the spectrum and the Bourne Ultimatum to my number 7, which is a completely different style of film, and that's Once. And this is a film, it's just a delightful little film for me. And according to our guest later on the show, Michael Phillips, he says so. It says so right on the screener the studio sent me. It may well be the best music film of our generation. Now, obviously, Mr. Phillips has not seen a little opus we call From Justin to Kelly. But this movie really does once, just makes me smile. It's a fleeting glimpse into two people's lives and the music that propels them together without being saccharine or overly precious. And I really do love this film.
I do, too. In fact, it's my number 7 film as well. And I have to admit, this is where my list really starts to give me a headache, because both of my next two choices certainly could easily be flipped around and could even be in my top 5. Once could have made my top 5. I love the film that much. It's the debut film from writer-director John Carney. And it's basically a musical set in Dublin with the two leads, Glenn Hansard and Markita Irglova, making a connection through music. And they're playing songs together that make up the movie's soundtrack. And I love the music. I love Hansard's unassuming, totally natural performance. And I even love the low-budget do-it-yourself aesthetic, which I think perfectly complements the story and these characters. And in fact, to set up my awe moment from Once, I want to go ahead and play a quick clip.
Well, you have suffered enough, and warred with yourself. It's time that you won. Yeah.
Well, there it is, Glenn Hansard and Markita Irglova singing Falling Slowly. This is the scene in the film, the first time they play a song together, I believe, in a music shop. And I got tingles from this scene throughout the entire song. I completely bought it as the first time these two individuals were playing the song together. It's the moment in the story when two new lovers kiss, except that we get it through the song rather through any kind of physical embrace. It's really great.
Well, I hate imagining you with tingles, but I do like your choice. My number 6 is The Lives of Others. Yes, it won the Oscar for Best Foreign Film last year, but it wasn't released here, at least widely, until 2007. Not only is it a great look at the totalitarianism of 1980s East Germany, but it works as a great thriller as well. And Ulrich Mayr, you can't say enough about his performance. He just absolutely shines as the dutiful bureaucrat asked to spy, of course, on a suspected subversive playwright. Tremendous, tremendous film.
Yeah, it really is a great film, and Ulrich Mayr, a tremendous performance. And as you mentioned during our top 5 performances of the year, tragically, we lost him this year, and he really is amazing in that film. Well, let's go ahead and close out the segment then, Maddie, with my number 6. And it is a film that we'll review when it opens in January, so I'm going to refrain from saying too much about it here. And it's Paul Thomas Anderson's There Will Be Blood. And all I really want to say right now is that I think he has pulled off an amazing cinematic achievement that for me comes undone in the last 20 or 30 minutes, and that's why it's out of my top 5 and not my number 1 or 2.
But it makes it into your number 6.
Yeah, it does, because it's that great of an achievement. I really do believe that, and I may regret having it this low when I see it again. I've already been agonizing over it far too much, but for now, this is where it will stay. And the awe moment, the near dialogue-free opening 15 minutes of this film that functions basically as an epilogue to the rest of the film. It introduces us to Daniel Day-Lewis's character, Daniel Plainview, and how he made his first money in the oil business. And it tells you everything you need to know about who Plainview is, what he stands for, and what the oil business is without a single line of dialogue. It's all in the camera, editing, sound design, and performances. It's really incredible, so I look forward to talking about that movie with you. You haven't seen it yet.
I have not seen it.
When we get to it in January. All right, well, it's time for a quick break. Later in the show, Michael Phillips will be joining us to get into our top 5 films of the year. When we come back, though, we're going to spend some time discussing 3 new movies opening this weekend: Charlie Wilson's War, Sweeney Todd, and Youth Without Youth. Stay with us.
I'll have a blue Christmas without you. I'll be so blue just thinking about you. Decorations of red on your green Christmas tree won't be the same, dear, if you're not here with me. No, 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 no.
Hey, I'm Ellen Page.
And I'm Diablo Cody.
We are the actor and writer of the film Juno, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
Congressman.
No, no, no. You get to call me Charlie. Can we get you a drink?
10 o'clock in the morning.
Fair enough, I guess.
I'm just wondering what you do for a living.
I'm Charlie Wilson. I represent the Texas 2nd Congressional District.
I'm standing on the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan. Afghans are now ready to fight a war against the Soviets. If they get weapons, they say they will win.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Maddie Robinson. I'm Adam Kempinar, and that was a clip from the trailer for the new film Charlie Wilson's War. Tom Hanks there, Julia Roberts, Philip Seymour Hoffman, an all-star cast, and Hanks plays the title character Charlie Wilson, a Texas congressman who basically single-handedly funds the Afghan Mujahideen in their battle against the Soviet Union. And it's a pretty amazing story about the fall of communism here that this one guy helped to bring about. And it's written by Aaron Sorkin, directed by Mike Nichols, of course, of The Graduate fame and many other films. But Sorkin as a writer, Maddie, is one of these guys who really does divide a lot of people. I know some people love The West Wing, other people just hate it. What do you think about Aaron Sorkin? What do you think about what he's done with this film?
Well, I love Aaron Sorkin. I think he deals really well with these types of characters. I, of course, identify with sleazy white guys, you know, who like to have a good time, who eventually end up doing good. And it's a lot of fun watching Philip Seymour Hoffman and Tom Hanks basically talk out of the sides of their mouths in this movie. It's a lot of fun. But overall, I thought it was just a tad cursory. Basically, I wanted more, and I wish Sorkin had been able to deal with this material in, say, a miniseries or a television series format, or maybe just a slice of the material in a stage play, because it all just seems too rushed. None of the great individual stories that he sets up really get told. And he employs some of his old techniques from West Wing. You have two characters engaged in
walking through a hallway.
Yeah, exactly. Engaged in a seemingly mundane task like dressing up as Santa before a Christmas party. And of course, they're talking about these weighty international affairs. And it doesn't really work. And the one that really doesn't work is his attempt to humanize the Russians. There's only one scene. He ignores the Russian side of this conflict altogether until this one scene, and it falls flat on its face. Don't do it. Don't even attempt it, because I like this film when it played out as this sort of 1980s Cold War document. Mm-hmm. We don't care about the Russians. They're this monolithic evil empire. You know, we're the good drunk white guys against them.
Well, I did enjoy this movie to a large extent as well. We had a very similar reaction, and I assume the scene you're talking about with the Russians where he attempts to humanize them, I guess, is the scene in the jet.
Yes.
Where two guys are talking about their love problems.
Yes.
Basically, it's horrible.
It doesn't work.
It's
at
really
all.
Horrible. It's one of the worst scenes I've seen in a film this year, and it actually is the point where I felt Charlie Wilson's War slipping completely off the rail, because up until that point, I was really having a lot of fun with this movie, about as much fun as Tom Hanks, I think, was having playing Charlie Wilson, good time Charlie Wilson, because he's just eating it up. And he's not being over the top. And we talked later how, you know, accent wise and everything, it's a little bit of a goof. Like, he knows he's having fun, but it is fun. And Philip Seymour Hoffman, of course, with these witty deadpan lines, is this CIA analyst, this really bitter, jaded, but really good CIA guy. He's really fantastic. I even really like Julia Roberts in it. And Aaron Sorkin is able to bring a lot of humor to something that is very serious at the same time. And he really mixes it well. But you're so right. There gets to be a point in this film where all of a sudden everything speeds up to a conclusion. We've had an hour of this great sort of procedural kind of thing of how did Tom Hanks become this guy who A, cared about something more than having a good time, and then B, actually pulled it off. That's all really fascinating. And then all of a sudden, we get a 7-year span where the Afghans are fighting the Soviets, and it goes by in a montage of like 10 minutes. And then we get to the end, and we have to get the Aaron Sorkin lesson and this big moral at the end of the film. And I'm all for the lesson he's trying to teach us, but you get to the end of it, and it feels like it hasn't earned it by that point.
Well, and he doesn't trust himself. He doesn't need to tag that on at the end, because out of all the films that we examined that discuss the current situation in Iraq or, you know, our current foreign affairs regarding the war on terror, this is the most fun. And I think it showcases how history makes strange bedfellows. And if we don't know our history, we're doomed to keep sleeping with the wrong people.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that lesson. He just doesn't need to hit us over the head like he does at the end.
No, you're exactly right. And it's funny, I read in Newsweek, actually, where Tom Hanks was saying how all these movies that are out this year that claim to not be about Iraq but really are, they really are, but this one isn't. This is about a war 20 years ago. Well, maybe you could tell yourself that, Tom, but really this is a movie that is trying to make this big lesson about Iraq. And unfortunately, we get it literally in about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't make the point very well, unfortunately. So it is a film I think we're both recommending. It's worth seeing, but maybe not a great movie by any means. Well, let's get on to Sweeney Todd, and this is the
Demon
Stephen
Bobber
Sondheim.
Fleet Street.
Yes, the Stephen Sondheim adaptation from his musical. Johnny Depp and Tim Burton back together again. Of course, it's a Tim Burton movie, so you're also going to have Helena Bonham Carter. Why don't we go ahead and hear a clip? Because I think one of the big questions we had going into this film, Johnny Depp, was he going to be any good? Could we buy him as this character? And could he sing? Let's find out.
Whisper. I'll listen. I know you've been locked out of sight all these years. Like me, my friend. Well, I've come home to find you waiting.
Well, I think he proves without a doubt. Of course, he was a musician before he became an actor. Johnny Depp is absolutely fantastic in this film, as is Helena Bonham Carter. And I think this is Tim Burton's best film in years. I love the production values behind this. It's dark. It moves at a really nice pace. But ultimately, I think it's sort of betrayed by a flatlining story in the middle. Once the bloodletting really starts, I don't know what role the violence is playing in his reversal as a character. Is he getting off on this? You know, is the revenge consuming him? I just was a little bit confused.
I think the revenge does consume him, but I'm not sure that that's that interesting to watch dramatically on screen, unfortunately. This is another film that we're on the same page here, I think, Maddie, because Johnny Depp really blew me away with this performance. You actually had him as an honorable mention, I think, in your top five of the year last week on the podcast, and he is really good. He can sing. No, he doesn't have this bombastic Broadway voice, but he doesn't need to.
No.
He's really sinister, and he's creepy, and he's interesting, and he sounds good. And where I will disagree with you is Helena Bonham Carter. I like her pretty much every time she's not singing.
No!
No, she doesn't enunciate. I can't understand what she's actually saying with that accent, and there's no projection.
You realize
at all.
She's from the streets of London.
I do, but I'm supposed to be able to understand what she's saying, I think, and I never could. So
you are an old fuddy.
I know. I didn't think she was that interesting, but you're right. This film has great production value, as you would expect from Tim Burton. And all of the supporting performances, I think, beyond Helena Bonham Carter, maybe, are really good. Alan Rickman is the villain, and there are many others. Timothy Spall, brilliant.
Exactly. Unfortunately, they're not given enough screen time.
No.
And neither is the other parallel relationship between the young beau and the daughter.
Right.
That really gets no screen time whatsoever. Those poor characters, I feel bad for them.
I know. I had the exact same reaction. I feel like there is a lot of slickness to this film.
Yeah.
It reminded me a lot, actually, of Dreamgirls. I like the movie better than Dreamgirls, but like that musical, very slick, but didn't really hit me on a substantive level. And then the music, I like Sondheim. I really do. But other than Pretty Women, I'm not sure that this movie has any songs that you walk out of the theater humming to yourself. I took nothing away from it in that regard.
Joanna.
Nah, it didn't work for me.
Something like that.
Apparently,
I'm imposing Bally High on it just to make it more memorable.
Yeah, maybe so. So Sweeney Todd is a good film and another one that is definitely worth checking out, but maybe doesn't rise to the level of greatness, I think, mainly because it does get to that point where Tim Burton starts to get off, I think, a little bit too much on the bloodletting. And it really does become a matter of scene after scene after scene of execution, and we don't even know who these people are. And I'm not familiar with the Sondheim musical, but I want to think that maybe there's a little bit of political commentary going on, social commentary going on in these people he's going after, maybe a little more upper crust, trying to get back at those people who hurt him the first time.
It speaks to the motivation.
Right.
Why is he doing this?
We don't
which
get
is
it
my
here.
Whole question.
No, and we don't get it here. So I do agree that I think the big problem, though, with the film is it's kind of like Charlie Wilson's War in that it just doesn't give us enough by the end. A lot of great setup, not enough character development. Even in a musical, that's something that should be there or something we want anyway.
All right, Adam. Well, you and I also saw a movie that affords a lot of character development, Youth Without Youth, of course, from Francis Ford Coppola. And I'm hoping maybe beyond the character sketch that it paints, you can tell me what this film was about.
I can't really tell you what it's about at all. I can give you the brief plot synopsis here,
okay,
which
please,
is that
please
simply
do. I'm hanging on this.
Yeah, Tim Roth plays a Romanian intellectual. He's 70. He gets struck by lightning, and instead of dying, he actually recovers and finds out that he's now 30 years younger.
That sounds like a great plot.
It does sound like a great plot.
My God, that's a starting point. Where could you go from there?
I don't know. Where it goes is he ends up realizing that he actually has this ability to just consume all knowledge, basically. He can just look at a book, more or less, and get the contents of it. And somehow Nazis get involved, and another person who has this past life that goes back to the beginning of time. This movie is all over the place.
Yeah. It's a mess.
It's a mess.
It becomes achingly dull, and that's its major sin. I really could not figure out what was going on here. And like I said, here is this great leaping off point, a guy who is reversing in age. That's terrific, and he does nothing with it. And Tim Roth is great, and I love watching him enveloping this character.
Yeah.
Really, but to what end? Again.
Yeah, I do agree with you that to what end? I don't know that the movie really answers that question, but I like this movie a little bit more than you because I didn't think it was achingly dull. I thought it was just
maybe stylish.
A little bit dull.
It's stylish.
It's really stylish. I mean, I love some of the camera tricks that Coppola is using here. I think that Coppola is a guy who I will indulge his experimentation and those maybe little idiosyncrasies that don't maybe work and ultimately don't add up to anything, but it's Coppola and I will go with it, whereas with another filmmaker, I might not. I like to see him experiment a little bit. I did love Tim Roth's performance, but you're right, the movie is all over the place. I couldn't make heads or tails of it, but I do still think it's something that someone should go out and see.
You have to be a hearty soul, achingly dull.
Okay, well, we disagree on that one. Let's take another quick break here, Maddie. Coming up next, Massacre Theater and our top five movies of the year with guest critic Michael Phillips. Stay with us.
You and I here all alone. Sunday morning here at home. The sky is blue as the coffee's strong. It's true.
Subject for experiments. Reflexes, memory things. So if I didn't do anything when I got the electric shock, well, I did this once, but I just did that for the experience, so it don't count. Okay. That's 80.
Do it again?
Yeah, sure, I don't care.
Double enough?
Double enough.
What is there, an echo in here?
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. It's time now for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where Adam and I massacre a scene we love and you, the listener, get a shot at winning a free DVD. Now, last week, Adam and I massacred the scene you just heard with Paul Newman and Forrest Whitaker from Martin Scorsese's The Color of Money, a tie-in with our top five lead performances of the year. And I have to say, Adam, that was a pretty nice Forrest Whitaker.
You like my Forrest Whitaker, huh? Well, I appreciate that, Maddie. Of course, Paul Newman winning Best Actor in 1987, Forrest Whitaker winning in 2007 for The Last King of Scotland.
Adam, reach into the film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Jeff Adams in Portland, Oregon. Congratulations, Jeff. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, and we will set you up with the DVD of your choice.
That was the greatest acting I have ever seen.
I just don't know how you do it, Gary. How do you make yourself so somber and emotional to make everybody cry like that?
It's not that hard, really. I just think about the saddest moment in my life.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and we're not going to give you any hints here. There really is nothing we need to tell you about this scene. The connection, the tie-in to the show should be pretty obvious, but we do have a note. I'm going to be trying to portray the actor in the scene. Maddie, you are going to be doing the scene as Christopher Walken.
I'm going to try.
You're going to try, just for fun here.
Yeah.
Okay, that's why it's called Massacre Theater. I started off, you give me the action.
And action.
You think I'm way off base here?
Yes. Well, a tad off base, sir. That thing looked like the Manson family Christmas special.
Well, it's a little late to get this kind of feedback.
That's because it's the first time I've ever seen it, sir.
You're right, I sprung it on you.
It's not that bad. Just like lose, you know, the part with the gun and the blood and the guy shooting up.
All right. If I can change it, I'll let you know in 5 minutes.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
You know, in a lot of ways, I think we're a little bit alike. Sir, Merry Christmas.
And scene.
Ouch,
all right. If you know what film we really massacred, email your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net by Wednesday, January 2nd.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on the January 4th podcast. To listen and to get official Massacre Theater rules, please visit www.filmspotting.net.
Hey, guys. This is Ryan Johnson calling from Los Angeles, and I wanted to call in and contribute with an end-of-the-year top five list, but I've pretty much spent the last year making my second movie, The Brothers Bloom, which hopefully I'll get to talk to you guys about sometime next year. And the only bad thing about spending a year making a movie is you don't get out to see new movies very much. So I've seen so pathetically little this year that I would feel like a real fraud trying to compile a top five list. But I did want to call in and give some love to one movie that I saw earlier in the year that really had an effect on me, the assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. Completely hear your guys' criticisms of it, and I have friends who felt the same way as you guys, but for whatever reason, I saw it and I just landed on the opposite side of the fence, and I really, really dug this movie. I hope that I haven't just used up all my film spotting cred. I hope that you guys still invite me on the show this year. I'm really enjoying them, and keep up the great work in the new year. Take care, guys. Bye.
We're ready now to continue our top 10 movies of the year countdown, ready for our top five. And that was a voicemail there from Ryan Johnson, the director of the movie Brick. And his choice, as he said, not necessarily the best film of the year, because he doesn't think he's seen enough films to really make that judgment. But I know a film our guest we're about to bring in really appreciates as well, The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. So we will see if it makes his list. And that person I'm talking about, of course, is Michael Phillips. You read him in the Chicago Tribune. You see him on Ebert and Roper, where he is fabulous. And you've also heard him here on Film Spotting. You were here, Michael, back in July for our top five movies of the year so far. We're very glad to have you back.
I deny those other five I mentioned,
okay,
too. That's all changed because the checks never came.
That's true. Yeah. They didn't. Well, before we get into your list, we do want to quickly recap our 10 through 6 so far, and then we want to get your 10 through 6 before we really dive into our top five. So, Maddie, why don't you go with your 10 through 6?
All right. My number 10 was Miranera's The Namesake. Number 9, Away From Her. Number 8, Into the Wild. Number 7, Once. Number 6, The Lives of Others.
My number 10, The King of Kong, A Fistful of Quarters. Number 9, Death Proof, Quentin Tarantino's half of Grindhouse. The Bourne Ultimatum. My number 7 was Once as well. And then my number 6 was Paul Thomas Anderson's There Will Be Blood. So let's hear your 10 through 6, and also let's talk a little bit about how you formed your list, because we were corresponding over email a little bit, and we talked about how agonizing this process really is. And you said an interesting thing, that ultimately, at the end of the day, it's between you and your Lord and how you form these lists, isn't it? So how did you and your Lord come out?
Or you and your atheist coach or whatever you want to. Oh, man, it was hard this year for the best reasons, because it was very hard for me to even get it down to, like, the top 23.
Yeah.
And then, which is a great sign in a way. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember struggling quite this way the last 2 years. But number 10, I would say, knocked up. Number 9, The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford. Number 8, The Bourne Ultimatum.
Wow.
Number 7, Margot at the Wedding. I'm kind of alone there.
Mm-hmm.
I know.
Fine, certainly in this
fine
room you are.
What's your number 6?
That's even too harsh for the people who made it, I know. Number 6, No End in Sight, which I think is the one
great
really indispensable documentary on the Iraq War.
Okay. Great choices there. Let's go ahead and jump into the top 5 then. Maddie, why don't you start us off?
All right. Well, my number 5 is After the Wedding. Now, I'm from a long line of stoic Scandinavian folk. We don't exactly wear our emotions on our sleeve. We're certainly not one for causing scenes. So to see my peeps, the normally reserved peeps,
uh-huh,
who play it so close to the vest, have to deal with the stakes as high as they are in this movie made it all the more rewarding and devastating to me. And the plot, I mean, it's sort of Ibsen-esque. And to that end, I'd love to get into the plot, but I don't want to give anything away.
Mm-hmm.
And it really quickly, the bombs under the tea table are revealed in the first act. And I think the fallout just makes for a devastatingly powerful movie. I loved it.
It's a really good film.
Really good film. It's like punk Ibsen.
Yeah.
You know, this is the kind of acting that really makes you realize how good some people are at selling the highest kind of melodrama without playing it all for false theatrics at all.
Yeah, absolutely. And Maddie, you actually had two of those performances on your top five performances of the year, the lead actress in that or supporting actress, depending on your perspective.
And then Rolf Losgaard.
And Rolf Losgaard, who is brilliant. And when we recorded that show, I hadn't seen After the Wedding yet, and I pledged to see it before we recorded this show, and I have. And you're absolutely right. It's a great film, and those are wonderful performances. So a great pick by you. Michael, you're number five.
Number five, There Will Be Blood. And that was, this was tough. This was, I mean, it was very easily placed in my top five, and I didn't quite know where. And I'm dying to see this again because of this incredibly controversial final third of the picture, although it's really more like a final fourth or fifth, but the final chapter where the story, I don't want to give it away, leaps into 1927. And again, don't want to do any spoilers here, but I mean, it's almost deliberately enraging on the part of writer-director Paul Thomas Anderson. But man, I think I'm convinced the first two-thirds of that picture is the American movie of the year.
Yeah, I think you're right, actually, and that really echoes what I said earlier in this show, and the only reason it's outside of my top five, and I really wrestled with putting it in my top five, but the only reason it's outside of the top five is because of that last 20 or 30 minutes, and I do want to see it again, and I don't want to get into it either and get into specifics before we really review it or spoil anything, but I think the movie goes off the rails a little bit in a very provocative, interesting way, but nevertheless, I don't know that it really matches what I love so much about the first two-thirds of the film.
Right. No, and it's a great sign to be able to say, I think, I must see that again to fully sort out my feelings on that, because so many movies you see all year, you guys know this, you know, you're very happy to never see it again. And even films you like and are very well crafted don't have enough in them kind of roiling around to pay off on a second visit in any way. So it's also just the performance of the last couple years, for my money, Daniel Day-Lewis, and it's a performance that has incredible size and weight to it,
and
real relish, and I don't know, I'm just dying to see it again.
Well, if we had more time and if we didn't want to give anything away, I would love to get into a debate about Daniel Day-Lewis's performance in this film, get into a discussion really, because it is fascinating like the film is as a whole. And I think the term I use, you talk about the weight to this film, I think of muscular. The whole film is just that opening 15 minutes even of the film where we see how he makes his first money drilling for oil there. It's just, it's bigger on this grand level than any other film this year.
Right, right. So what's your number five?
Okay, well, my number five is a movie that I almost feel a little bit embarrassed about putting above There Will Be Blood after everything we've just said about it, but it's Juno. It's not the grand achievement There Will Be Blood is, but I think it's a gem of a film in its own right, and it is the film that I laughed the hardest at this year, which I think qualifies it for some kind of transcendence. And actually, let me go back for a second, Michael. When I set up my top 10, I tried to use this kind of criteria that was, I factored in how much enjoyment I got out of watching the movie, obviously, the rewatchability factor, how much did I want to see it again, just as we do with There Will Be Blood. And then I factored in this notion of transcendence, where literally you almost feel giddy in your seat watching the movie. And so I tried to look for movies that had those awe moments, I'm calling them. And I think that, as I said, Juno, with some of the laughs in this film, I think it takes it to that level of transcendence. And Ellen Page gives my favorite female performance of the year as the snarky know-it-all teen who gets pregnant and decides to give the baby up for adoption. And as she says at one point, has to deal with some things way beyond her maturity level. And my awe moment that I singled out is the scene where Juno tells her parents, J.K. Simmons and Allison Janney, that she's pregnant. You're really expecting at this point the worst possible reaction because we've seen it a million times. We think we have anyway. We've seen these parents a million times on screen, and there's no way it's going to go well. And then the parents end up being obviously shocked but supportive. And it's mostly played for laughs, but everything about it I thought was totally believable. And it has my favorite line in the movie where J.K. Simmons says to his daughter, Ellen Page, "I didn't know you were that type of girl." Mm-hmm. And she says, "I think I'm still trying to figure out what kind of girl I am." And that's the movie in a nutshell, and it's a great line.
The one thing I quibble with you on is I'm not sure how much of it's technically believable, but all of it's disarming. And I'll tell you, this is a case where it took me two viewings to really appreciate it.
Really?
Yeah, I saw it up at the Toronto Film Festival with this sort of hyena crowd that was just so insanely supportive. They were drowning out everything, and it really played into the comic rhythm of the piece and kind of destroyed the emotional underpinning. And I mean, you know, look, it was like probably day whatever four of a fatiguing schedule, I'm learning more and more not to trust my own perceptions at a film festival anyway because of
the
sleep factors.
I know.
But second time through, really sharp, and I agree, Ellen Page, probably the female performance of the year.
Well, it's certainly an absurd scene like so many are. There's a heightened level to it. Nevertheless, I still felt like I bought those parents responding that way. I think I could see that anyway, or right. at least the movie made me believe that. So I saw Juno in Toronto as well, but I saw it with a press audience that really took a while to warm up to it, just as I did. And I know I just recently read your review, actually, and we really did have a very similar reaction, where the first 15 minutes of this film, I was ready to just write it off. I wanted to get up and leave because of some of the dialogue, and then it really just falls into place.
Right.
Yeah, well, you
right.
get worried because you've seen that film before,
yeah.
and you think it's going to go down that road. But I've got a little bit more to say about it. I think it might sneak up here on
okay,
my list.
That's
so
true.
I'll go to my number four. And that is This Is England. And I just caught up with this film, and I was pretty fairly blown away because I think it's, as a timepiece, it's pretty brilliantly realized, capturing sort of the zeitgeist of Thatcher's England. And it's so believable why this kid, this little kid, would get swept up by these gangs. And you start with the performances. They're just so nuanced, so convincing, and you can see why anyone would buy into them. And I love that this movie is specific to 1982, but it's just as relevant today in sort of examining the composition and the strength of our going gang
mm-hmm.
culture.
Yeah.
I loved it.
I'm with you. I just recently saw This Is England as well and really enjoyed it. Stephen Graham's performance as the leader of this gang of skinheads, I think, is really remarkable. Michael, you're number four.
Number four, Ratatouille. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's snuck on anyone else.
No.
Yeah, heartless bastards. I really thought it's just a truly a ravishing looking picture, and it's the only animated feature I've seen, certainly in English, in the last 10 years that had any kind of the panache of the old days. And it's really that's a story that does not go anywhere where you expect it to. And I don't feel that they were the Brad Bird, the writer director, who's really kind of the best guy working in this field right now with The Incredibles, and you know, that he wasn't following any template, and you know, and just for the score by Michael Giacchino alone, which is really just symphonically kind of stunning
mm-hmm.
and very moving. I would recommend tracks 22 and 24, by the way. Lovely. And it doesn't all work, but, you know, hey, do you all work?
No.
You know?
No, certainly on this show we don't.
You have flaws,
yes,
certainly.
Yes, we do.
Yes.
You're right. And I think that's my problem with the film is that maybe I saw too many of the flaws. You're right, certainly to look at, it's absolutely brilliant. But my big problem with that movie is that the most interesting character by far is the rat and not the guy he ends up helping out, who ends up being the main character, who is one of the blandest main characters of the year. And they end up putting the interesting guy, the interesting rat, underneath his hat for a large part of the film. We have to deal with the bland guy.
Yeah. That it is a flaw. The writing and the voice work in that role of Linguini,
mm-hmm.
you know, the young male human lead of this thing.
Yeah.
You know, it is not the strong suit of the picture. Mm-hmm. And it is a problem.
Not as strong as Patton Oswalt.
No.
Or Janine Garofalo, who I think is really good.
Okay.
Brad Garrett is Gusteau the chef. Yeah, no, the
You're
voice
right.
work's pretty good. But
yeah.
That felt like cashing in on a favor or something, or just a friendship.
Maybe.
Yeah, hiring Lula Rama for that. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's get to my number four then. And let's go ahead and hear a clip.
It's not that hard. You just got to know where to start. In the first cipher.
You actually carry that around with you?
Why?
No reason.
What's the most common double consonant in the English language?
Consonant?
The double L.
Double L.
And what's the one word that we know that he'll use in here at least once? Right, kill. So the Hardens start looking for double symbols, which they find here, here, and here, each with the same two symbols preceding them. So now they've got a repeating four-letter word ending with two symbols that they assume stand for L.
Since I think the whole word is kill.
And you got your K, you got your I, and you're on your way.
This was my number one film of the year so far back in July because it was the movie I was most eager to see again, and that is Zodiac. And beautifully shot and edited, I think, David Fincher's film. His attention to detail and the way he fills a frame and uses tracking shots, all kind of shots, is amazing, I think. Great performances from Robert Downey Jr. as the journalist who gets on this case of the Zodiac Killer. Mark Ruffalo as the detective is great. And even Jake Gyllenhaal. I know you don't like him, Michael Phillips, in this role, and I don't like him in a lot of roles, but I actually think this is one instance where that doe-eyed act of his kind of works because he's playing this naive Boy Scout who gets in way over his head. So it kind of works. It certainly doesn't derail the film. The awe moment of Zodiac for me, you could take any of the Zodiac murder sequences, I think, the one with Ione Sky and the baby in the car, the two lovers in broad daylight. I actually couldn't watch it last night. I just had to fast forward through it by the water. And the creepiest of all is when Gyllenhaal goes into the basement with someone he suspects could be the Zodiac killer. It's really hard to watch, but honestly, my favorite scene in the movie is the opening murder to Donovan's hurdy-gurdy mm-hmm. man. The use of color, the point of view shots, and the music. It's a clinic, I think, in creating suspense. I love Zodiac. It's my number four.
Yeah, well, we talk about how Ratatouille was a technical achievement. I think David Fincher's style saved this from being merely like a made-for-TV movie, and also the performances as well, because I do love the style of this movie, mm-hmm. but I wasn't as brought into it. Maybe it was Jake Gyllenhaal.
That was my issue with it. And mm-hmm. Can we talk a little bit about the cinematography, too?
Yes.
Harris Savides. I mean,
yes.
This year was an extraordinary year for cinematography.
It was.
Which, you know, you have like two amazing films by Roger Deakins, No Country for Old Men, and The Assassination of Jesse James, like two completely different looks at the old and the new Old West.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Harris Savides stuff, you know, Janusz Kaminski's
yeah.
work with Julian Schnabel and The Diving Bell and the Butterfly.
Oh, yep.
I just haven't seen a film year like this where the visual splendors have been this rich.
I totally agree. And Roger Deakins, didn't he also do In the Valley of Ayla
yep.
for Paul Haggis,
yep.
which he actually made that film kind of interesting to look at
right.
as well
no,
because he's so brilliant.
And a totally different, you know, deliberately kind
yeah.
of drab, monochromatic palette, very different from the other work. Yeah,
yeah and it. You mentioned Harris Savides. I brought up the fact that he did Zodiac and Margot at the Wedding, which couldn't be more polar opposites
right.
in the way they're shot. So it was a really interesting year for cinematography. Well, we're going to get into our top three movies of the year coming up in the next segment. Stay with us.
Does Satan wear a suit and tie? Does he work at the Dairy Queen? Does he listen to rock and roll? Does he feed the mean? Singing hallelujah, 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 hallelujah.
Time now to take a look at what is new on DVD this week, and right now it seems to be a pretty bleak week.
It's not looking
Maddie.
Good out there.
Rush Hour 3, it does include director's commentary from Brett Ratner.
Oh, good. He can explain that one.
Also out, The Kingdom, a movie with Jennifer Garner. Peter Berg directed that film, set in the Middle East, War on Terror, Jason Bateman, Jamie Foxx.
I think some of our listeners like this one.
Maybe a few. I know a few others, though, wrote in and said it was one of the worst movies of the year, so we may have to find out for ourselves here now that The Kingdom is out on DVD. And then Shoot 'Em Up, Maddie. I don't think you have seen Shoot 'Em Up yet.
No.
Actually, the last movie Sam reviewed with me here on the show, and it was a good battle over it. I thought it was good, vulgar fun. Sam hated it. That film is out now. So
do they include that as a DVD extra?
The Adam and Sam battle?
Yeah.
They should.
We should.
Maybe we'll have to add that ourselves, our own little director's commentary on that film. So that's what's new on DVD coming out this week.
All right, we want to thank those people now that found their way over to the Film Spotting website and gave us some of their hard-earned dollars. We can't stress enough how humbled we are by each and every donation. And of course, here are your Sam Van Halgren nicknames. David, Heavy D and the Goys. Brian, the Rhapsodic Rump Shaker. Christina, the Periodic Symbol for Samsonite. Nicholas, Fistful of Justice. Carol, You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Beggar, a.k.a. The Lasting Treasure of a Moment's Pleasure. That's a platinum donor. Thank you so much, Carol. George, Where Angels Fear Their Bread. Paul, Symptoms of Majesty, a.k.a. Prognosis Awesome, another silver donation. Lee, Wants to Break Your Dust Bowl. And Steve, Bionic When I Feel Like It.
Yes, thank you to all of our donors, and especially Paul, of course, who has been a platinum donor in the past with another Silver Club donation here. And Carol, that is her second Platinum Club donation to this show. I actually think it's safe to say that she is the single biggest donor to this show right now, and we really do appreciate it. I think maybe we need to pay her back, Maddie, with a private one-man Maddie ballgame performance.
All right. Just this one time, I will do Chris Walken reading the night before Christmas.
No, I mean you have to go to Carol's house and perform for her.
That's what I was talking
okay,
about.
Okay, there you go. That's on the table right now for you, Carol. You know where to find us, feedback@filmspotting.net. Thanks again to everyone.
Power of example, my mama said it, and I heard. She said 1 ounce of action beats a ton of words. Singing hallelujah. And mama said there would be angels. Hallelujah. And mama said there would be sun. Is the devil in Elvis to go when a white man went?
Film Spotting's Top 5 is presented by Spout.com. Share your lists, reviews, and discuss movies with your friends for free at filmspotting.spout.com.
Hey, Adam and Maddie, I hear what you're saying, but you're completely wrong about everything.
Sam Van Halgren here, calling from Milwaukee. Hey guys, well I guess the fact that I'm still debating between two films for Best of the Year bragging rights that I saw in August says nothing about the presumed quality of the films released between my departure from Film Spotting in this very moment. Rather, It has everything to do with the fact that I've seen more episodes of Freaks and Geeks than I have movies since September. Like, probably three times as many totally awesome episodes of Freaks and Geeks. But I did see No Country for Old Men, and while a fine achievement, it is not better than my very favorite film of the year, which is, I'm deciding right now as I leave this message, Rescue Don. Werner Herzog is my boy, but The Bourne Ultimatum is a close second. And at number 15, No Country for Old Men has nothing to be ashamed of. Happy New Year, film spotters. See you soon. Bye.
You are listening to Film Spotting with Matty Robinson. I'm Adam Kempinar, and our guest this week from the Chicago Tribune, the fine film critic Michael Phillips. And we heard there one of our guest voicemailers, Sam Van Halgren, former co-host here on Film Spotting, weighing in with his number one film of the year. I believe it was his number one film of the year back in July, and that is Rescue Dawn, the Werner Herzog film. Still his number one, though he hasn't seen, as he said there in the voicemail, he hasn't seen as many of the films that we have at this point, some of the later year stuff. So we'll see as he gets into some of those films if Rescue Dawn still holds up, but a movie I definitely liked. Before we get back into our countdown, we're ready to get into our 1 through 3 films of the year. We did want to check in with our poll questions. Our poll results for last week, we asked you from Film Spotting selections, my vote for Best Supporting Actor of 2007 would be Javier Bardem in No Country for Old Men, Hal Holbrook in Into the Wild, Toby Kebbell from Control, Irfan Khan from The Namesake, J.K. Simmons from Juno, and Kurt Russell in Death Proof. Maddie, how did the results come out?
It was a runaway for Mr. Bardem, coming in at number one at 76%, Irfan Khan coming in at 8%, and Kurt Russell tied with him at 8%, J.K. Simmons garnering 5%, Hal Holbrook in at 3%, and 1% for my man, Toby Kebbell.
Two votes there for Toby Kebbell, and you were one of them, so one other Film Spotting listener.
This is the manager.
Yeah.
Great
I think
performance.
It's terrific.
Yeah, but he didn't have that slaughterhouse stun gun, you know, which people
exactly
tend to remember, you know, because that was the manager of, I think, the Sex Pistols carried that around.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, before we get to this week's poll question, Michael, how would you have weighed in on that question?
On that particular poll, mm-hmm. I would have thrown it out.
You would have thrown it out?
This feels wrong to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really do love, I have to say, I love Kebbell and Control, so I guess I'm the 1%. I love Hal Holbrook in Into the Wild, a film I had a lot of issues with, but I think it really, not just because of Holbrook, but I think the film kind of finds itself in those desert sequences,
mm-hmm.
and largely because of the way Holbrook's really, really doing wonderful work.
Yeah.
It's the kind of part he hasn't had a chance at in a long time. So,
that's true.
Yeah, I probably would have gone Holbrook.
Okay.
And, you know, look, I don't have any issues with Javier Bardem's performance.
Mm-hmm.
I just find myself at a remove from the insane rapture over that film.
Mm-hmm.
Much
okay.
as I liked it.
I know. This week's poll question, we want to know what you think is the most overrated movie of 2007. And this does tie in a little bit here. We're praising movies at the end of the year. Why not tear some down a little bit? And we came up with 5 choices, basically looked at Rotten Tomatoes and Metacritic, saw movies that are generally getting praise from film critics, high ratings here, and we did also pick movies that have been out for a little while, so these are movies that most of you should have had a chance to see, as opposed to some of these movies like There Will Be Blood that haven't really come out yet. So the choices are for overrated movies, Maddie.
All right, Bourne Ultimatum, Knocked Up, Michael Clayton, No Country for Old Men, or Michael Phillips's Ratatouille.
Michael?
I only wish it was my right. That film was made $614 million worldwide. Well, No Country out of that list. I mean, look, 3.5 stars in the Trib. I think the craftsmanship is impeccable.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's
mm-hmm.
the Coen's best movie since, you know, at least since Fargo. And I do find, though, that if it wins Best Picture this year at the Oscars, which it probably will, it's going to be the same kind of uneasy feeling I had when Silence of the Lambs won back in 91 or 2, I forget.
Yeah.
I just feel like it's a beautifully made serial killer movie in the end, and I don't think there's any there. It doesn't matter in a way just because it works as pure thriller craft, you know, and I really can't. And just for the dog sequence alone,
yes.
it's 3 of the best minutes of film I saw this year. But
yeah,
of that list, I probably have the most issues with No Country.
Okay, blasphemy. Maddie, your pick.
I think I'm going to have to go with Knocked Up. I loved it. I think Michael Phillips, earlier this year, you called it sort of a shaggy film. And yeah, I had my problems with it. I think it sort of fell in love with its characters and a little bit too much.
Okay. Well, for me, I think from that list, it's tough because it's between Michael Clayton, a movie I like, and Ratatouille, a movie I like, but in terms of overrated, maybe I'm going to go with Michael Clayton just because of the fact that it was the most nominated film from the Chicago Film Critics Association, 7 nominations, and for me, it would have made maybe my top 25 of the year. So I'm going with Michael Clayton. Let us know what you think. Vote at filmspotting.net. And with that, we get back into our countdown, our top 3 movies of the year. Maddie, your number 3.
All right, well, my number 3 is Juno. And for me, I think it's just the smartest, most refreshing comedy in years. And I'm sort of running out of things to praise this film for. I'm sort of becoming a bumper sticker, you know, it's a celebration of life. So a friend asked me to recommend a movie the other day, and I said, go see Juno. He said, why should I go see it? I said, well, because I'm completely out of ammunition on this. I said, if Juno were a woman, I would try and marry her. This film, or at least I would buy her a lot of drinks. And
nice.
I think she'd be too smart to have me.
Yes.
But I really did love this film.
You would try to intoxicate the movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Well, now I'm really intrigued, though, Maddie, because up until at least 2 weeks ago, I thought this was a lock for your number one. So now I really can't wait to get to your top 2 films of the year. Michael, what about you?
Number 3 is a tough, uncompromising picture, but really stayed with me. 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days, the Romanian drama, which has, I think, right or wrong, become known as the Romanian abortion drama.
Mm-hmm.
In a year where the subject of abortion and unwanted pregnancy has been sort of lurking on a whole bunch of other titles this year, but
Juno,
amazing,
Lake
yeah,
of Fire.
I mean, knocked
yeah.
up. It's this director writer Cristian Mundiu is really working in an incredible tradition of Romanian kind of sardonic realism, and I haven't seen anything that was that weirdly gripping in a very mm-hmm. mundane way, almost like hyper-realistic
yes.
style, establishing this really calm, implacable camera sense as the story follows this unbelievable kind of travail of these two young Bucharest women sharing a dorm room. And it's just really, I haven't seen a film like it all year or maybe in my lifetime. So yeah, number 3.
It's a really amazing film, and it's one of those movies that would go on my list of one-timers, movies that I think are brilliant in many ways, but I'm not in a hurry to see it again.
No.
Because it's a tough sit.
It was a tough sit, and I avoided it for a long time because I really responded strongly to it when I saw it back in May at Cannes.
Yeah.
And I did. I did not put that in lightly again a second time just because of it is a grueling experience. But I got to say, I think it's an honorable one.
Yeah, definitely. Those long takes, though, the most oppressive I've felt watching a movie all year, just heaviness that I almost wanted to turn it off because it got to be too much. But that's a great thing, of course, that a movie can do that, I think. So a great choice there. My number 3 is The Diving Bell and The Butterfly, Julian Schnabel's adaptation of Jean-Dominique Bobie's memoir, which he wrote after suffering a stroke that left him unable to move any part of his body except his left eye. So he wrote his memoir by blinking. And it's a movie I've been telling everyone to go see if they have a chance, even if I know they're not the type of person that would usually want to seek out a movie with subtitles and very art house like this film is. But I just think the story is that incredible. And the way Schnabel puts Bobie's imagination and memories on screen with these visual flights of fancy is transporting. And it's an escape for us, just as it was for him, his only escape because he was locked in. And for me, that awe moment that I singled out, well, pretty much any scene with Marie-José Croce in front of the camera, his therapist, she's just a heavenly presence. And of course, the opening 15 minutes or so, which is all shot from Bobie's point of view, is the most claustrophobic I felt watching a movie this year. Part of me wanted to just get up and leave the theater, much like with 4 months, because I felt trapped. Mm. And then that, of course, made me reflect on the fact that I felt trapped. Imagine how he felt. He didn't have that choice of getting up and leaving. In a movie with all those tremendous visual flourishes, the two simple scenes, though, with his father, Max von Sydow, were among the most moving I saw all year. And you mentioned Janusz Kaminski. The cinematography, of course, is brilliant in this film. So my number 3.
All right. Well, my number 2, this one's from Michael Phillips, No Country for Old Men.
I'm just happy it's not number 1.
Yeah, exactly.
Oops.
I really do. I feel like putty in the Coens brothers' hands. I think they're that good in this film. And I know a lot of people are having problem with the narrative structure, specifically the ending. And I just think they're just having so much fun. They're just such great master storytellers. I don't resent what they're doing at all. I just sort of smile and go along for the ride, and I loved it.
Okay, then, Michael, your number 2 film of the year.
Right with you. For me, number 2, The Diving Bell and The Butterfly, mm-hmm. which looked unbelievably good on a second viewing, for one thing. And I think you mentioned Adam, the first 15 minutes, that really just sort of striking perspective of not just his point of view as he's in the hospital, but really behind his one mm-hmm. good eye. And, you know, you think, how much can I physically handle
yeah.
this perspective? But it's not shot like a horror film or even a high melodrama. And again, any other director would have handled it in much more of a kind of overtly scary way, but there's something about the perspective shifts and everything that feels at once completely plausible in sort of a medical way and yet utterly of the imagination. Mm-hmm. And that's where the film takes you from there. I'm really, really in love with this thing.
Yeah, I am too, obviously. And I read something interesting too where they talk about how they filmed those scenes and they did it live in a way where the actor was actually in another room and could hear what the actress was saying and was responding to her. A lot of those little lines of dialogue where he's making little comments about how beautiful the nurses are and stuff, he was actually responding to what they were saying and improvising a lot of that. Pretty incredible stuff. So glad to hear you love that movie as well.
Love it.
Which brings us to my number two, and it's the movie Atonement. It's Joe Wright's follow-up to Pride and Prejudice. Keira Knightley in this film, as she was in Pride and Prejudice, James McAvoy as well. It's a romance. It's a movie about the power of words and the purpose of art. And as I said during our review a couple weeks ago, I don't want to comment on the story any more than that. I hope people go in totally ignorant about this film, just as I did in Toronto. I believe, Michael, we were at the same screening at like 11:30 at night. I expected to just be bored to tears and have trouble staying awake, and I was really riveted by this film, and I think it's just full of surprises. And if you've already read, of course, the Ian McEwan novel, the revered Ian McEwan novel, you don't have that option of going in totally ignorant. But I think it's an amazing film, and for me, the awe moment, of course, Dunkirk, the beach scene there, 1,000 extras, 5.5-minute unbroken take that's breathtaking, and I do think adds something to the story in addition to just being artistically brilliant. And then the last 15 minutes. And that's all I'll say about it because, again, I don't want to give anything away about it. I think it will reduce the power of the last 15 minutes of the film. But I have to say, my little tangent here, my little soapbox, I'm getting sick of reading critics who are lukewarm on this film who can't get past the fact that they love the novel. I keep reading this. People keep feeling the need to point out how brilliant the book was, and the movie just doesn't match it. And specifically, for example, a review like Lisa Schwartzbaum in Entertainment Weekly, she points out that the book is just devastating, whereas you watch the end of the movie and you get to the end and you feel like, well, that was nice, but now what's for dinner? And I keep thinking to myself, is it really Joe Wright's fault and Christopher Hampton, the screenwriter, or is it your fault for not being able to get past the fact that you knew it was coming? There isn't a surprise for you when you know the book and you love it. Of course it's going to be more devastating the first time around. Why don't they just acknowledge that, I guess, is what I'm bothered by.
That's a good point. It's the thing you can never measure is what how you would have responded to the film version
right.
of a book you loved if you had not read the book.
Yep.
You can never determine for sure your response, and it's all guesswork from there. But I agree with that. I think it's a very fine film. I think the first half is a real masterpiece.
Yes.
And I think, you know, I have some issues with the tone and, you know, a bit of the romanticism for me goes over the top in the second half. That doesn't give any story points mm-hmm. away. But you mentioned Christopher Hampton, the screenwriter. If David Hare had gotten a hold of this thing, he would have pounded it into the ground with no wit and all sort of stern craft. Mm-hmm. And Christopher Hampton, who also wrote, among other things, the stage and film version of Les Liaisons de Giroux, you know, really witty man.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he gets this kind of English provincial country house vibe.
Yeah.
Just with this sort of, not with a wink in his eye, really, but it is really an exquisitely paced and calibrated first hour. And it's a really good mystery. And sort of a mm-hmm. and the moral conundrum in the middle
yeah.
is taken seriously.
Well, we are ready then for the big moment. We're going to get to our number one. Maddie, I can't wait.
Well,
what's your favorite film
I
of the year?
I think it's going to surprise you a little bit, and it is The Wind That Shakes the Barley.
If we lose half this colon, it's not readily replaceable. The Brits see you, they're going to kill you. The Brits catch you, they're going to kill you. Rory. Right, did you see our position when you came over the crest of that hill? Okay. You did not. You were looking down at your shoes, trying to pick your way through the mud and keep your shoes clean. There'd be clean shoes on your corpse.
I'm a sucker for historical dramas, and this is about as vivid and insightful as the genre comes. And it tells, of course, the story of two Irish brothers caught up in the fight for independence against the English in the early 20th century. The movie is unflinching in its documenting atrocities on both sides of the war, and it highlighting why revolutions, not just the Irish Revolution, tend to trip over themselves in the process. I love Cillian Murphy and Paul Rigg Delaney. I'm, of course, butchering their names. I think they're just phenomenal in the leads as the brothers.
I have no excuse for this one. I did not catch up with this movie yet. I really did intend to see it. Should have been watching it instead of rewatching Zodiac last night, I'm sure. But I will catch up with it very soon here. The One That Shakes the Barley, Michael.
A good, solid film. Yeah, and people have short memories, and I think some people have forgotten it. Ken Loach is not a dynamic filmmaker and never has been, but he's told a very satisfying story here, and this is going to be turning into Irish Night in just a second. So that's all I'm going to say.
Well,
I'm not going to say anymore.
I think we're ready for it. Go ahead and hit us with it. You're number one.
My number one. I tried not to pick this thing. You know, it's the cheapest, simplest film in my entire list, and that includes like my entire top 23. But my favorite film of the year, really, the one that left me with the best feeling that I can't really quantify, is the Irish film Once. And if it's a slight choice, you know, sue me. And last year, my number one film was the Turkish relationship drama Climate. So, you know, maybe I just needed a break.
Yeah.
So cut me a break. Okay.
Okay.
No, I love the film. Mm-hmm. And it's I think it's artfully artless, if you want to go for the obvious paradox. And it's not a film, I think, that's going to be necessarily studied in years to come, even by aficionados of the musical, because this is sort of a demi-musical.
Mm-hmm.
But I think all I can remember is the feeling I had when that screening I saw at Sundance, you know, was over, and I thought, man, I've just been taken for the kind of, you know, 90 minutes that I would kill for once a month, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I love it.
Well, it's a great choice, obviously,
touring, our top 10. Are they touring the country as an actual group?
I believe so. We've had many listeners write in and talk about having the chance to see the two performers perform those songs live, and it really would be a treat to see. My number one film of the year, I am sorry, Michael Phillips. Before I say it, why don't we let one of our guest voicemailers say it?
Hey, Adam, it's Steve Procopi from Ain't It Cool News Capone. This is one of the hardest years ever to do this, but I think the one that always sort of comes back to for me is the Coen Brothers' No Country for Old Men. We can speak volumes about the tone of the film and the look of the film and the fantastic performances. One of the greatest screen villains of all time, played by Javier Bardem. But really what it comes down to are the Coen brothers just always trying to find ways to challenge their audience's expectations and play with the conventions of film and the conventions of cinematic storytelling and just flipping it on its head almost defiantly and saying, we're not going to do what you think we're going to do. You know, basically this film just kicked ass 18 different ways. And so that's my pick.
Our friend Steve Procopi from Ain't It Cool News there, and I have to agree with him. Obviously, No Country for Old Men, the Coen Brothers film, is my number one movie of the year. And another critic who really summed up my feelings about the film, certainly what I tried to express when we reviewed it, is Jim Emerson, who wrote, shot by shot, cut by cut, sequence by sequence, no movie this year or any other year, he says, was more grippingly, cinematically exhilarating than No Country for Old Men. And I think he's exactly right. I know, Michael, as you said, you've questioned whether there's anything more to it beyond just kind of the artifice and the brilliance of the Coen brothers and their craft, but I think there is substance to it. I think it's a meditation on mortality in many ways, an examination of free will and the futility and, for lack of a better word, the horror of living in a world without any rules, where there's no sort of divine force telling us how we should all behave, and a world in which someone like Anton Chigurh can exist. I think it is dealing with a little bit more just beyond a great serial killer movie. That all said, it works on that level as well, and for me, the awe moment, if I had to single out one scene, it would be the dog sequence, of course, which I think is just brilliant, where Josh Brolin is on the run and a dog chases him into the water. But really, it's the whole film. As Jim Emerson said, shot by shot, cut by cut, sequence by sequence, I was giddy throughout the entire movie.
Yeah, I know, 3.5 stars, I made my top 20, you know, it's not a film I have any contempt for or anything,
mm-hmm.
but I think the rap that the Coens may have kind of a comic contempt for almost everybody in the picture here and there weakens it a little bit. I think on some level the Coens really could give a rip about the moral consequences of any of the violence in this thing.
No.
I think they're just more interested in kind of what that stun gun can do. and it can do a lot, you know.
Yeah.
And I think it is a brilliantly crafted and really well-acted film. I would point to Dave Kerr's stuff on his blog, Dave Kerr, Doug,
mm-hmm.
and he's written, you know, he has much less respect for the picture than I do, but he, I think, has concretized a little bit of what is bugging some of us about it. But nonetheless, it made my top 20, so
okay.
I'm not complaining, really.
I look forward to checking out what Dave Kerr has to say about it.
All right. Well, those are our top 10 movies of 2007. Please send your list or any other feedback about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
Opening wide this weekend, two of the movies we reviewed on this show and do recommend, though with some reservations, maybe Charlie Wilson's War and Sweeney Todd. One movie we haven't seen yet but can't wait, Walk Hard, The Dewey Cox Story. And one movie we haven't seen yet and can wait until we're trapped on a flight with nothing to read, National Treasure, Book of Secrets. Expanding to more screens in limited release, three films that really deserve your time, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, as you heard. Here in this countdown, Atonement and Juno, and also The Savages with Philip Seymour Hoffman and Laura Linney, a movie everyone seems to adore but us, Maddie.
All right.
I guess we're just going to have to be out all alone on that one.
We will be off over the Christmas holiday and back with a podcast on Friday, January 4th. We hope to have a review of P.T. Anderson's There Will Be Blood, much praised on this show, and also The Great Debaters, starring and directed by Denzel Washington. Thanks to Martin Sexton and Kitchen Table Records for this week's music. Learn more at kitchentablerecords.com. To all our listener volunteers, Alex, Angela, Frank, and Candace, and to Joe Dassault at Chicago Public Radio for his invaluable production assistance, thank you, thank you, thank you.
We do appreciate it. We also want to say thank you to all of our devoted listeners this year for your support and wonderful feedback. Saying goodbye to one host and welcoming in a new one could have been a lot more challenging than it was, and everyone's kind words and encouragement really made the transition a smooth one. It's been a great run. We look forward to another exciting year ahead. Definitely some major news we hope to share come early January. Maddie, finally, we want to say thank you to you, Michael Phillips. It really has been a treat, an honor to have you on the show. And once again, it was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Thanks. It was fun, guys.
Okay. For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Maddie Robinson. Thanks for listening and happy holidays.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is brought to you by Spout. Visit filmspotting.spout.com to discuss this episode.
I was confused as to what part it was playing in this reversal, in this transmogrification.
What the transmogrification?
Good Lord.
Did you try to just pull that out, Maddie?
Give me a drink.
Wow. Holy Lord.
Let's go back to...
Usually Maddie pulls off the big words,
though. Let's go back to Tom Hanks for a second.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Joe. That's enough.
Do you remember where you were, though?
No.